Good morning. Welcome to iDisney Issues. I'm your host, Hugh LaFollette. On the show this week, I'll be talking with Stan Maless, professor of education at Simpson College, and our topic is going to be Shakespeare. Stan, glad to have you on the show.
Thanks, Hugh. It's good to be here.
All right, the reason I invited you was because of a book that you co-authored called Coined by Shakespeare. It might be helpful to give the listener a sense of what the book is like, what motivated the project, and then we can proceed to talk a little bit about its content.
Yeah, the book was published in January of 98, and it's a dictionary-style collection of about, well, it's 208 words that discuss some of the words that are attributed to Shakespeare as coinages. There's one disclaimer on this, that these are words that first appear in Shakespeare, and there's hardly any way to know that these were actually invented by Shakespeare, but by way of Merriam-Webster's databases and some of our research, it points to that these are the first appearances of those words. So there's 208 of them in the book, and we trace the etymology of the word and follow it through into its current usage and in its variations. My co-author, Jeffrey McQuain, we've been working together for the last 20, 25 years. We taught together in Montgomery County, Maryland, and published a little glossary of grammar literature terms back in 88 called The Elements of English, and we followed up on that same format with Coined by Shakespeare.
Okay, I wonder if you could give us some examples. I mean, clearly we don't have time to talk about 208 words unless you just give a long litany. Maybe pick some. Well, I tell you what, let's do it this way. Why don't you talk about the ways in which he coined them? Did he just make them up out of the blue, or are there some different characteristics of the way in which he coined them? And then perhaps give some examples.
Yeah. I'm always reminded of one of Aldous Huxley's lines that Shakespeare was a genius of all trades, and it really holds true. He exercised an incredibly enormous freedom with invention, especially with his words. Remember, the 17th century, 16th century was really a time of a lot of experimentation in language. There was translation. All of the Latin and Greek greats, the classics, were being translated into English for the first time. The Bible was finding its way into English by way of psalms and books, and Coverdale had his Bible early in the 16th century, and the King James Version certainly in 1610. And Shakespeare was tuned into all this, and he used a number of techniques to create words for the first time. One of those was to just simply take proper names use them as in context, like Academe or Olympian. Promethean he uses for the first time. Zany. Zany is kind of an interesting word. It comes from the Italian as well as being a proper name. It's one of those borrowings from a modern language. Other foreign adoptions come from French. Cater, dauntless. Retirement, lackluster he uses for the first time, and this is a carryover from the practice in French of using sans, the word which translates as lack. So there's a lot of lackluster as well as sans things, sans this and sans that. Spanish he borrows alligator and anchovy, and Italian he also uses bandit for the first time. And words from Scandinavian countries like swagger and gust are some of the best examples. I think rant comes from Dutch. And the old High German shudder is another word that he borrows. So he borrows from proper names that were out there, especially from the classics, the Greek and Roman classics. He borrows from the modern languages of the time, and he also borrows from the Old English quite a bit. These are a number of the word combinations, roadway, eyeball, watchdog. Those are all coming out of that Old English tradition. Other compounds that he uses as another way of creating words, taking two existing words and combining them to form one idea, would be an example of which would be bedroom, birthplace. Bloodstained is another. He takes the idea of skim milk and uses it figuratively as someone who is weak-willed. Moonbeam is for the first time, as is leapfrog. And so the compounding of words is another way that he coins. The use of prefixes and suffixes especially are widespread. In fact, one commentator described him in one place as making public love to a prefix. He talks about traitors and steep to enclog the guiltless keel in Othello, and we find a lot of those new words with the French en prefixed attached. Dis, D-I-S, is found in discontent, dislocate. The un words are everywhere. Suffixes like ing words that we find in questioning and splitting are also Shakespeare's coinages, as are baseless and dauntless and noiseless. L-Y words, as well as M-E-N-T words and S-H-I-P words. Another commentator said that Love's Labor's Lost, the play, is really the playground of the new language, and there's over 15 to 20 new coinages just in that play alone. It's a marvelous piece of invention. Another technique that he uses is back formation, where an existing word, usually in Latin, is shortened to the word that it exists today. Criticus becomes critic, for example. Then there's a lot of functional shift, nouns to verbs. Champion and film and label are examples of those. Verbs to nouns, verb to adjectives, and adjectives to noun, and so on. Those are probably the most prevalent of techniques. Also, the usual onomata poetic words like bump and buzzer, those are coinages of his as well. And lots of borrowings, of course, from Greek and Latin derivatives. There are a lot of words that never made it, too, and this has always been a curiosity of mine. Words from Scandinavian origins as well as the Latin and Greek origins. Conspectivity comes to mind. It appears in Coriolanus. Underskinker is one of my favorites as an assistant to a bartender or a waiter. That never made it past 1 Henry 4. And the verb to sneep is a very interesting word that never made it out of Love's Labor's Lost, although we can still find it in the dictionary today. Sneeping is an ancestor of our word snub. It means something like to chide. Another one of his inventions from Greek roots is anthropophaginian, which he uses to identify a cannibal, a man-eater, anthropos and phagos in Merry Wives of Windsor. So there's a lot of words that he played around with that have been forgotten and maybe resurface one of these days in the future.
But many of them have been picked up, and there's an interesting question. I mean, why is it, I mean, if I suddenly coin 208 words, my guess is that very few of them, and maybe none of them will ever make it. What was it about Shakespeare that made people pick up and use his words?
Well, I would think that many of them have to do with, well, they're representative of people in action. These are staged performances, and so as far as the imitation of life, people are seeing themselves on stage, and I think the medium of the drama has had a lot to do with the adoption of these words. The only other rival to Shakespeare was the Bible, and Chaucer comes in there too, but the Bible, for other reasons having to do with the sacred, are really those the words that stay with us too. But next to that, I think probably the enactment of human life on stage has something to do with it. And then, of course, we get into the 19th century and the canonization of Shakespeare, and it's something that's taught in the schools, and I think that's probably working against Shakespeare. But I think that might have something to do with it. There are also a lot of his words that take specific actions and develop lasting traits. Quarrelsome is a good example, as is laughable from The Merchant of Venice. Stealthy is another word that we find very often in today's usage. The adjectival form stealth bomber, of course, is one of the best examples of that. Accused from Richard II is a another word that finds direct application today, where Richard says he takes two opposing parties and says that he will hear the accuser and the accused freely speak. It's almost as if he were speaking today. Sanctimonious is another word that Shakespeare coins, and incidentally, that usage is almost exactly the same that we would use today as someone being hypocritically pious. Worthless is another coin, third part of Henry the Sixth. And so there are some of the, many of his words have to do with actions that become human traits. Also, there are actions that become abilities of single persons, individuals, and among those are manager, Love's Labor's Lost. Critic is another example of how abilities have become attributes or actions become attributes or abilities of single people, of an individual. Employer is another one. And incidentally, there too, there are many words that Shakespeare coined that are business-related and for a lot of, I think, obvious reasons have found their way into current usage today because of our business climate. Investment is one, retirement, employer, manager, marketable, advertising, undervalue, negotiate. So those are the kinds of words that find their way into these larger conceptual models. Conditions as well are developed through Shakespeare's words. For instance, retirement is found in 1 Henry 4. Be all and end all, Macbeth's famous line. And discontent is another. Now is the winter of our discontent, from Richard III. So these are words that find a home away from home in current usage.
When I think about Shakespeare too, in fact, I was kind of intrigued when I read your book. When I think about Shakespeare and his legacy to us in language, it's been more phrases and idiomatic expressions, and I was kind of intrigued to discover just how many words were there as well. But I'd like to shift maybe and talk a little bit about those phrases and idioms. It seems to me that there are any number of them that are in regular usage, and perhaps people don't even know that they've come from Shakespeare. Maybe it'd be helpful just to begin by mentioning a number that you think are really important, and then perhaps we can pick on some of them and talk about them in more detail.
Sure. I think most everyone knows the "to be or not to be" speech from Hamlet. That turns up in many, many places. It was a chapter of a book that I just opened the other day, and we see it almost daily in a variety of places. Brevity is the soul of wit is a good one from Hamlet, and Hamlet is one of those plays that supplies us with not only a lot of new words, but a lot of new ideas, things that border on the consciousness, the individual consciousness.
Could you elaborate on that point?
Pardon me?
Could you just elaborate on that, what you mean by how it elaborates or helps us understand individual consciousness?
Yeah, I've read a very interesting commentary in a new book by Antonio Damasio, who is the head of the Department of Neurology at University of Iowa. The book is called The Feeling of What Happens, and in there he presents the notion that that consciousness is made up of a number of different aspects, and not to go into his idea in depth, but he posits what he calls an extended consciousness as opposed to a core consciousness and then a proto-self. But this extended consciousness, he explains, found its way into the literary tradition through Shakespeare. This is the same theme that is picked up by Harold Bloom in his Shakespeare, The Invention of the Human. It has to do with the feeling of what happens. I think that is the title of Damasio's book. Hamlet and Falstaff, according to Harold Bloom, are perfect exemplars of that as characters. They help us to question who we are because that's what they do. These are some of the first characters probably the most important characters who we can actually witness questioning their motives, questioning their words. In other words, they reinvent themselves continuously and are always aware of their actions. DiMaggio says that in this extended consciousness appears in Shakespeare, and it's curious that the word itself doesn't appear until 1632. In Shakespeare, the closest it comes is conscionable, but that's synonymous with the idea, with the word conscience, which does appear a lot in Shakespeare. And DiMaggio makes this point that conscience, as Hamlet says, conscience does make cowards of us all, but the concept of conscience exists in Shakespeare's plays, but the notion of extended consciousness, although it's there, hasn't yet been named or identified. And so between DiMaggio and Bloom, this idea of consciousness appearing by way of the actions of the characters is extremely important for our understanding of ourselves today. So the notion of consciousness, I think, is a real interesting key to understanding Shakespeare and the connection with us as human beings today.
All right, let me pause briefly for the benefit of anyone who's tuned in late. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest today is Stan Maless, professor of education at Simpson College, and our topic is Shakespeare. So in the last third of the show here, maybe continue to talk a little bit more about some of the examples of phrases and idioms and how they shape our understanding of ourselves. But I thought about two in particular to describe very different phenomena in the terms that I hear regularly. One, on the one hand, you got a charmed life.
Right.
On the other hand, you've got the phrase star-crossed. Star-crossed lovers from Romeo and Juliet.
Right.
And I know particularly the last phrase, I remember hearing the term used any number of times when John Kennedy Jr. recently died. Are those terms something that you find particularly interesting, or?
That's a good point. And those are the kinds of words that come out of that historical tradition, of course, the astrological tradition that that was so much a part of Chaucer's English. The idea of star-crossed lovers and a charmed life certainly are a part of Shakespeare's understanding of fate as another moving concept out there. I think that there are other phrases that that touch on exactly what you're saying.
Okay.
And many of these have to do with, they're echoes from the Bible. They're echoes from, and we just can't get away from the King James Version. It was such an important influence at that time, as was Coverdale earlier. But the King James Version, with that beautiful English, is echoed in many of Shakespeare's plays, mainly because the ideas from the Bible were practiced in school during the late 1500s and early 1600s. It was the practice of sententia, where the students would copy down important lines and they would memorize them in their day books or table books. And those phrases, and those key phrases, and most of them were biblical in origin, would stay with people and eventually surface. And I think Shakespeare is a perfect example of that, and I think there must be something there that triggers this larger idea of consciousness and conscience. But remember, he has Polonius say this whole string of almost clichés. They're clichés to us now, but Polonius is saying, to thine own self be true. He's telling Laertes, and neither a borrower nor a lender be. We find also in Hamlet the notion, or the line that there's special providence in the fall of a sparrow, which is almost a direct echo. I think it's from Matthew. He continues in a very interesting way with that line, by the way. He says, there's special providence in the fall of a sparrow. If it be now, 'tis not to come. If it be not to come, it will be now. If it be not now, yet it will come. The readiness is all. And I think that's another one of those phrases that finds its way into our modern consciousness. He finishes that that speech, by the way, by saying, since no man has aught of what he leaves, what is it to leave the times? Let be. And that whole notion of let be is a large ontological question, I suppose, for a lot of us. But also in that play, there are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy. those kinds of ideas that we hear over and over. Frailty, thy name is woman, is another that probably has had a great deal of influence on our thinking. Even little things like Clement Moore's line, a mouse stirring, is found in the early part of Hamlet, where he says, not a mouse stirring, and describing the silence of that arena that he's in. It can go on and on and on. My favorite, couple of my favorite lines, though, that I think have something to do with this larger issue of consciousness and the connection with the modern, are the lines that have to do with the world as a stage. And those, of course, are probably recognizable to most of us. In As You Like It, where Jake says, all the world is a stage, and all the men and women merely players. Very curious question in there, that we begin wondering who are the spectators if all the world is a stage, and of course that posits some larger supreme understanding, I suppose. And then we have Prospero talking in The Tempest, we are such stuff as dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded with a sleep. These are questions that Damasio's book, the author that I mentioned earlier, takes up in a very, very interesting way. Damasio says that in this proto-self that's part of this larger development of consciousness, we have a wordless storytelling going on, a wordless script. And this is something that we are unaware of, but it does take on the character of a stuff that dreams are made on, and that our life is rounded with a sleep. And it's very curious that Shakespeare, in this move towards consciousness that he seems to be making, is able to elaborate figuratively many of these ideas, and almost have to wonder if he really is really onto something there in terms of what in contemporary neurology, somebody has the stature of Damasio here at the University of Iowa was able to articulate in a very recent book.
Let me ask on this issue of consciousness. I mean, and I'll confess I choose these examples because they're on my mind right now. I'm teaching a course in punishment. I don't remember where, but the term premeditated, which plays a fairly important role, certainly in understanding and characterizing certain kinds of murder, but in general in our understanding of responsibility. And, you know, is that, are we indebted to Shakespeare for helping us not just have the word premeditated, but thinking about what it would mean for an act to be premeditated?
Yeah, that's right. And I think that actually appears in one of the Henry, I think it's a part one of Henry the Sixth. And somebody, my notes here, that somebody is saying writing has been dismissed as deep premeditated lines. And I think you're right, that these are words that somehow touch a part of consciousness, I guess, or lack of a better way to say that right now, that seems to take very easily to human beingness. And I think it has probably something to do with our ability to question internally, to invent ourselves and reinvent ourselves, as Bloom says. And to premeditate means to think on something in terms of an early mediation of an idea. And of course, that, you know, these are words that are coming out of Greek and Latin classics too. So there are almost in another world, in the Greek and Latin classical world, these probably had similar connotations or similar meanings, but it took a Shakespeare to translate them into English so that the concepts that are there, or whatever is imminent in that idea, finds its way into our understanding.
One more, if I could toss out and wonder what you'd have to say about it, is the phrase soft-hearted, which certainly has to do with a character trait and perhaps initially defined in terms of how we see someone else behaving, but then gets used to describe ourselves.
Yeah, the soft-hearted is another one of the Henry the Sixth words, and actually Margaret is, I think Queen Margaret is berating Suffolk there as a soft-hearted wretch. And soft-hearted is sort of fits in with those words like skim milk and puppy dog. These are figurative words that all suggest weakness of will in our individual being. And there are a number of words like that that do show up in Shakespeare. But you know, it's funny. They're figurative, and are very powerful as such.
Yeah, it does seem to me that many of the words and phrases that we use are based upon some kind of a figurative use, metaphorical use. The idea that a heart would be soft rather than rigid indicates that it's malleable. Perhaps,
as would be the skim milk, and right. You know, then it gets into, you know, the skim milk takes you into on one of its correspondences to the milk of human kindness, and so it becomes all related in that way, I suppose.
Well, look, we've just got about 2.5 minutes mm-hmm. left here, and I wonder if you might want to try to pull all this together, maybe talk about some more words and what you see as the long term significance of Shakespeare, and perhaps what we can learn from spending more time reading him.
Well, my approach to this comes from a philosophical interest as well as an interest in education, especially public education. And I've been trying to find ways, and I've been encouraging as many people as I can to use this material in the classroom. I would like to believe that we could return eventually to some sense of philology as it was practiced at one time. Even when I was in high school, we had units in Greek and Latin prefixes, but there was an interest in language as such. And I think that Shakespeare and Shakespeare's works provide us with what Milton called the Bible the Great Manifesto of Freedom, and I think that Shakespeare's canon, or at least some of those plays approached that way, can lead us to a larger understanding of who we are and a larger understanding of what it means to be free and independent thinkers. And we can do that by way of individual words and the beautiful, beautiful history that both retrospectively as well and prospectively for each word, but how those words, as you've said, come together in phrases, and also how they come together in large measure into characters, and how those characters can mirror some of our most important traits as human beings. So I think educationally, there's a great value to getting to Shakespeare from a different angle rather than from the culture wars kinds of arguments or the canonicity of it all, but as a fantastic way to get to an understanding of language as representative of our human being, and that's where a lot of my interest and work has been going with the book itself.
So words are not just tools we use, they help shape the way we understand and think about ourselves.
Yes, absolutely. That's probably the best way to say it.
Okay. Well, it's been wonderful talking to you today. I wish we had more time, but I'm afraid we're out of time.
It's been really my pleasure, and thank you very much for asking me to be a part of your wonderful series.
All right. I've been speaking today with Stan Maless, professor of education at Simpson College, and our topic has been Shakespeare. This is Hugh Follett, Fridays and Issues. Good day. We'll be right back.